You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. The study and treatment of autism in America has a long and complicated history. Until recently, many assumed it was a very rare condition. However, after changes to the definition in mid-1990s, we've seen an explosion in the population of people who have been diagnosed with symptoms of autism. Just a few years ago, some were calling it an epidemic. Our next guest has been looking into autism, talking to people living with it, their family members, researchers. He says we may need to fundamentally rethink our understanding of autism. Steve Silberman joins us now to talk about his New York Times bestselling book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a privilege to be here.
Well, some common thinking about autism is that it's something new. It's emerged all of a sudden as an epidemic. You say in your research, no, not really. Why is that?
That's the thing. I completely understand why parents are very frightened by sort of the constant stream of news stories talking about an autism epidemic and attributing it to everything from pesticides to living near freeways to Wi-Fi, et cetera. And as someone who's been writing about autism as a science writer for really over about 15 years, I started to become concerned that almost all of the social discussion about autism that was happening really all over the world was focused on sort of this week's cause du jour. You know, obviously we all know that there were huge arguments about vaccines that are still going on, actually. And, you know, every science story that comes along really tends to attribute the growth in diagnoses to this or that alleged cause in the environment. However, I knew that some of the old-time researchers in autism understood that what had really changed the most about autism was its definition. That back in the 1970s, when autism was indeed very, very rarely diagnosed, in fact, only 3.5 children in 10,000 were estimated as having autism back then, to now, when the CDC estimates that it's 1 in 68 American school children, that the framework of autism had completely changed, and the diagnosis had become much more inclusive and expansive. For instance, now it's very common to say that so-and-so is on the spectrum or so-and-so has a child on the spectrum. Well, back in the 1970s, there was no spectrum. Autism was understood as this very narrowly defined, exceptionally rare form of childhood psychosis. Most psychiatrists in America blamed autism on bad parenting, and it was a really terrible time for families because in addition to struggling with the very real daily needs of raising an autistic child, they had to deal with this burden of guilt and shame by being blamed for their children's autism. And in fact, the recommended treatment for autism back then was institutionalization. So two generations of autistic kids born in the 50s and the 70s were put in institutions, and that made them invisible to the larger society. So something that people say to me often is, well, where were all the autistic people when I was growing up? I never saw them. Well, the autistic people who were profoundly disabled were in institutions, and the autistic people who were, you know, what we would now call geeky or eccentric or whatever, did not have a diagnosis and were just sort of struggling to get by without any word that helped explain why they were struggling.
And you write that the focus on, well, the supposed explosion of autism and what you were just talking about, the idea that we need to find the modern day cause, distracts from maybe an important issue, and that's adaptation. How does someone with autism, profound, mild, otherwise, get along in daily life here in the United States? How can we help them do that?
That's exactly true. And, you know, for the last 10 years or so, we have spent over $1 billion on autism research. And, you know, we tend to think that that means that as a society, we're taking autism very seriously. Well, where is that money going? That money is going into finding more candidate genes for autism, genes that might contribute to the condition, or finding more alleged environmental triggers. And, you know, that's very interesting science. I'm a science writer. I love science. Many of my friends work in autism science. It's certainly a fascinating pursuit. But here's the problem. At the same time that all this science is going on, families of autistic children and autistic people themselves are being hung out to dry. Because when kids graduate from high school, they are what autism parents call age out of services. So basically, there are very, very few services, and none in many areas of the country, available to help kids who can work and who want desperately to somehow contribute to their society, to help them learn the things that they need to know how to do that will help them get jobs. And not only that, there are many issues around autism that are still relatively under-researched. For instance, what is autism in women? Is it very different than what autism is in men? Historically, four times as many boys as girls have been diagnosed with autism. I think that it's possible that it's because autism expresses itself very differently in women, and we still know very little about that. Unbelievably, we know so little about the lives of autistic adults. And believe it or not, a government report came out in June that showed that the amount of research into improving the lives of autistic adults has actually fallen in recent years, which is beyond belief. We don't even know how many autistic adults are out there struggling to get by without a diagnosis in the community. So one of the main points of my book is that if we want to really take autism seriously, we have to start taking care of the people who are here already and their families who are really suffering and really left out in the cold.
We're talking to Steve Silberman about his new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And Steve, another main point of your book seems to be we need to change the way we think about autism. And this is coming, it sounds like, from researchers, from people with autism themselves, not necessarily as a disease condition or a mental health disorder. Maybe it's a handicap, or maybe it's just part of a natural spectrum of, as you say in your title, neurodiversity. Can you talk about what changing that mindset would mean?
Sure. Well, probably the word neurodiversity has become sort of controversial. Probably the quickest explanation for it that I can come up with is great minds don't necessarily think alike. Many of the aspects of science and culture and technology that we take for granted have been invented by people with autistic traits or people with dyslexia or people with ADHD or bipolar. And so what we have to start thinking about is a range of varieties of human cognition, or different ways to think, different kinds of minds, as the autistic writer Temple Grandin puts it. She herself is one of the leading industrial designers in the field of raising livestock, and she has talked about in her books about how the eccentricities of her brain and the ways that she thinks that are typical to autism have really helped her work. And so there's a huge population of people who are eager to make contributions to our society, but because we focus so exclusively on children rather than autistic adults, and because we focus so exclusively on uncovering the cause. I mean, we've been searching for the cause of schizophrenia, for decades, and we haven't found it. For a long time, we were searching for the cause of homosexuality, and we didn't find it. These are very, very complex genetic conditions. And so we can keep doing that for another decade and another $1 billion, or we can start offering autistic people and their families the help they desperately need.
And the idea here, for the benefit to people who don't have autism, is, hey, maybe this is a missed opportunity. Maybe there are a lot of minds out there that could solve some of our problems that we'll never know if we don't figure out a way to connect our society to the way they think.
That's exactly right. And, in a rainforest, biodiversity is considered a strength and a survival advantage. It increases the resiliency of the community of plants that are growing there. We have to start thinking about neurodiversity as a strength and a source of resiliency and creativity for the human community.
We're talking to author Steve Silberman about his new book on the history and future of autism. It's called Neurotribes, and you can join the conversation. Is this your story? Are you dealing with autism in your daily life, for you or someone in your family? What kind of changes, what kind of accommodations could make the world an easier place to live? Parents, how has having an autistic child affected your family and your life? What do you think is the best way to think about autism, to work with the condition in the future? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. He says we need to change the way we think about autism and work to make the world a friendlier, more manageable place for people with autism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have friends or family or students on the autism spectrum, or is that you yourself? What kind of things can help in daily routines when dealing with autism? Parents, how has autism affected your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Jean is on the line in La Crosse. Jean, hi.
Hi, I married into a family in which there is a person who we believe is somewhere on the autism spectrum, and I found it extremely difficult to find information. Most of it was, again, as you pointed out, is based on children, and particularly for adults who were not diagnosed as, you know, having any, you know, neural specialization or neurodiversity, and for that reason, their family suffered, and there's little support for finding out how to even deal with that person, let alone maybe find some help for that person becoming a contributing member to society. There seems to be a lot of work done in England on adults with Asperger's in particular, which is kind of what I think that we're looking at. But I applaud your efforts.
Jean, thanks a lot for that call. And Steve, part of the idea of Neurotribes is that some of those adults with autism are starting to find each other and work through these issues. Can you talk about how people with autism themselves are working to change things?
Yeah, well, one of the sort of landmark things that happened in the late 80s and early 90s was that once the diagnosis became available to adults, partly through the invention of the diagnosis of the Asperger syndrome condition in England, as Jean, the caller, just pointed out. By the way, in many ways, I think England has been ahead of us by a couple of decades, because they already knew that autistic children become autistic adults back in the 80s. And so they've been really setting up things like permanent living spaces for autistic people and supportive communities. The National Autistic Society in England devotes 2/3 of its funding to services for adults, as opposed to the NIH here, which devotes less than 2% of its research to researching adults. I do want to, by the way, mention for Jean and for other callers out there, I have a page on my website, stevesilberman.com, that's stevesilberman.com/resources. The resources are a list of books that will help people who either think they may be autistic themselves, or perhaps they have a close relative who they think might be autistic. It will help them both determine if they really are autistic and also help them navigate this world that can be very difficult to navigate for a person on the spectrum. So there are a lot of helpful books listed there for Jean and for any other people who are listening. I'm sorry, what did you ask me? I sort of got distracted.
Oh, no, you were getting to it there. But adults now with autism are getting together,
oh,
they're
yes,
becoming
yes, yes.
activists too.
Yeah. So what happened in the really in the 1990s was that the internet emerged, and it turns out that the internet is like a very comfortable place for many people on the spectrum to talk to one another. They don't have to make sense of social signals in real time. They don't have to parse body language or tone of voice. They don't have to look in the person's eyes, which can be very distracting for a person with autism. They can take as much time as they need to compose their thoughts. Of course, as many of your listeners know, there are many autistic people who can't use spoken language at all, or who periodically can't use spoken language, but get them behind a keyboard and they're rocking the house. So, in fact, I have several friends who basically can't speak, but who are incredibly articulate with a keyboard. So the internet became a place where autistic people could share the stories of their lives with each other, and once they were able to do that, they sort of lost patience with the notion that all of their intense fascinations for things and their interest in science fiction and technology, that these were merely expressions of psychopathology. They started to value their own and each other's lives in a way outside of the kind of medical model of talking about autism as a form of illness. And so they started to build organizations like the Autism Women's Network, the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and other organizations that are basically run by autistic people for autistic people. And those organizations, particularly the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, are starting to have a real impact on public policy around autism. And it's not just for their impact does not just benefit so-called high-functioning people with Asperger syndrome. I don't like to use the phrases high and low functioning for reasons I explain in the book, but anyway, they really benefit people at all points on the spectrum. Like ASAN recently convinced the Department of Transportation to issue guidelines on making commercial air travel more comfortable for people on the spectrum and their families of all ages. So anyway, the autistic people who have always been historically left out of conversations about their future are now taking a central role in determining the policies that will help them and their families.
Gene, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk to Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, I want to get a little more into making the world a more approachable place for someone with autism. You give an example of, I think it was a tech company who changed their interview process, because in a face-to-face interview, I mean, that could be a nightmare or even an impossibility for some people with autism. But if presented with the right test, the right puzzle to solve, they could prove themselves as a really effective employee.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have a very limited idea of who makes a good employee. You know, what are human resources departments looking for? They're looking for good people persons, candidates, or, you know, people who can really sell themselves in an interview. Well, those are, you know, not the traditional strengths of people on the spectrum. However, there's a company called Specialistern, which hires programmers and software debuggers who are on the spectrum for even the giant German software company SAP. And what they did was, they replaced face-to-face interviews where, you know, the interviewer basically tries to see if the person on the other side of the desk will fit in with the social culture of the office. They replaced that with allowing interview candidates to build Lego Mindstorm robots and really just show off what they can do with hands-on work. And that's the kind of skill set that comes very naturally to autistic people and draws on the natural strengths of the autistic brain. And so, by widening our conception of who might make a valuable employee, depending on the task that they're committed to, we can really take advantage of the strengths of minds that have been traditionally left out of the workplace.
And one practical step, I think you mentioned some schools are doing or looking at getting to students now. People with autism, maybe in a school, just need a quiet room, a low sensory stimulation environment to get to when that you know, being surrounded by other kids and faces and voices is a little too much.
Yeah, well, there are many different ways of sort of customizing the environment so that it's more comfortable for people on the spectrum. For instance, many people on the spectrum are bothered by fluorescent lights. Neurotypical people, that is, non-autistic people, you know, don't even notice. But for an autistic person, it can be, you know, the fluorescent light can be buzzing and flickering and could even trigger a seizure. And so by paying attention to the sensory needs of autistic children and allowing them to customize their own space as much as possible, and also by presenting the lessons and the curricula in forms that take advantage of their natural aptitudes, we'll be able to give a better educational experience to those children.
Very briefly, Steve, as we wrap up, is this a turning point? Do you think things are going to improve in the way the rest of society interacts with the members of society who have autism?
Well, I don't, you know, obviously I sat in my room for 5 years, 80 hours a week, writing my little book. I didn't have such grandiose aims, although my hope was that I would be able to change the conversation. But Yeah, it's, you know, it just, the book just became a bestseller on the New York Times list. So hopefully people are reading it, and hopefully they're carrying the message into their own lives.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Silberman. We've been talking about the history, the present, and the future of autism. His new book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity.